Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Protests continue across the country last night against police brutality and racism in the death of George Floyd, an unarmed black man who died at the hands of a police officer in Minneapolis last week. Lancaster's protests of police brutality and racial injustice have had their tense moments, but have been peaceful for the most part. Lancaster Mayor Doreen Sirachi said Sunday's testier standoff may have been infiltrated by white supremacists. Joining us on the program today is Lancaster City Council President Ismael Smith Wade L. Councilman, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, Scott. Thank you for having me. How are you this morning?
I am doing well. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Councilman, all these protests across the country, and there are many of them, hundreds of them, they're similar in a lot of ways, but probably there are some unique features to each one. What's unique about Lancaster's demonstrations?
I think what's unique about Lancaster's demonstration, Scott, is the level of engagement of all members of our community. So I've been out since Saturday, and I've seen council members, the mayor, honestly, kids I knew from growing up, as well as members of the clergy, all both standing together to protest police brutality and racial oppression, as you mentioned. But also all of those same groups of people locking arm in arm to keep the peace. And that's been great to see, Scott.
Yesterday, there were several members of the Lancaster Police Department that actually walked with those protesters. Tell us about that and what effect or what impact does that have?
Yeah, so I want to call out Adam Donnell and Todd Greger, Lancaster City sworn officers in particular, though there were others. It had a really significant impact, Scott. People notice when their, you know, government employees, government officials come out there and join them. And that's something that they've been asking for days. And as you mentioned, across the country, in those cities and towns, where police officers and police chiefs have gotten out there with the protesters, they've been able to bring a higher level of calm. And, you know, not that calm is necessarily always what's called for, but knowing that the police feel that they have an active stake in keeping the peace definitely goes a long way for some.
When you say that calm is not always called for, Sunday's demonstration was a little testier than the other days. And from what I understand, there are marches, demonstrations scheduled starting at 11 o'clock every day this week in Lancaster. But Sunday's was a little bit different. Police used pepper spray on a few people. There were several arrests. Yesterday, Mayor Sirachi and the police chief came out and said that they thought that the demonstrations have been infiltrated by maybe even white supremacists, but at least some instigators. Did you see that?
Yes, Scott, I want to differentiate between two things specifically. I did see several people, and many of the people that I was with also identified several persons that we believe to be suspicious white agitators, and not just on looking and saying, oh, here's a white man, they don't belong at this protest, to be specific, but due to their behavior, the presence of firearms, certain tattoos and other things. And I think that's very real. And I also want to be clear that I think that that's not the only thing that led to tensions. But I did see those people specifically, and not only were they alarming on Sunday, I think if you talk to the crowd, if you talk to the city officials who were present on the street last night, that alarmed us through the evening.
When you say tattoos, what kind of tattoos?
So are you familiar with, for example, the Greek phrase Molon Labay, come and take it? It's popular with certain, particularly pro-gun groups, certain conservative elements and white nationalists. And that's not to say that the presence of that tattoo is immediately to say that this person is a white nationalist. But given that the presence of the, don't tread on me gear and other paraphernalia, and again, you know, with some fairly unusual and erratic behavior on the part of some of these guys, left a number of us worried that they were not present at the protest for the purpose or the aims of the protest we were having.
You marched with the protesters. Why?
Well, Scott, I'm a black man, and in fact, I'm in a unique position here, both being, you know, at least partially responsible for our police officers, and having been on the receiving end, frankly, of, you know, less than ideal treatment from police officers. And more than anything, this is my city, and I feel a responsibility to keep all of my people safe, and that includes both my police officers, but also the people who are out there on the street who might not be wearing body armor. I think, you know, they also need protection from that conflict. And if I and other elected officials, as they've done all weekend, can put ourselves and put our bodies between those people and conflict, I think that's a good day's work. Yeah.
When you say that you have experienced some of this at the hands of police, tell us about it. What kind of experiences have you had?
That's a big question there, Scott. You know, and it is very personal. So, you know, I'll recount one incident where a few years ago I was bringing my mother, God rest her soul.
Hey, who's been on my show before, and yes, I agree, God rest her soul.
I was bringing my mother some paperwork when she was parked. An officer had pulled her over, and they were having what seemed like a fairly cordial conversation. I did not want to get in the way, so I simply placed the paperwork on the seat through the open window, and then was backing away from the car when the officer saw me, jumped back and drew his firearm. And, you know, my mother, Scott, is very protective. And so this, at the time, 61, 62, year old woman, jumped out of the car. And I think the officer was just startled, but that the immediate drawing of the firearm, you know, put a 60-something-year-old woman who had just finished chemotherapy, she felt obliged to put herself between that firearm and me. And, Scott, I got to say, man, if you don't know what love looks like, that's it.
Wow. The Lancaster Police Department's the department has had complaints filed against it in the past, and even the recent past. But is police misconduct an issue in Lancaster, especially when it comes to people of color?
You know, Scott, I think that it is, and it's going to be the case almost anywhere you look at in our region, not just because of, you know, anything about our region or anything intrinsic about the individual police officers that we have. But this is a longstanding institution with a history of, yes, good, and also a lot of abuses. And there are cultures there that need to be transitioned. And somebody needs to do direct work to ensure that officers, for example, those officers who might be working nights, who only see the bad stuff from the calls they get at 2 a.m. Somebody needs to be working with them to ensure that that's not the impression that they develop of all of our communities. Because if they can't do anything to bring themselves to recognizing the fundamental goodness and deservingness of all people, and that can be hard when you're seeing the bad stuff night after night, then they can't adequately protect and serve our communities.
You know, something you just brought up, when you see bad stuff night after night, and that sometimes if you are in an area, your patrol is in an area where there are mostly minorities, you know, I'm not justifying it, but you could see how some officers would say, well, you know, this is why I have to be afraid, or this is what I'm to expect. So how do you get a police officer to not think that way when that's what they are dealing with, when you say on a night after night basis?
Right, Scott, that's an excellent point. And it takes like a continual effort at culture change. It takes a continual conversational effort. And officers have to be regularly engaged on that every time. You know, it's said that, you know, human interaction, actually meeting people, is toxic to racism and prejudice. And I'm not sure that that's always the case. But one thing it seems like we could do is make sure that those same officers aren't always the ones seeing the same things night after night, and make sure that they're actually exposed to the people in their community who are trying to make it better. And if I may editorialize a little bit, I think the same question is on the minds of a lot of Black and brown people. Right. Officers say that they see the same bad things night after night after night. And so they develop these impressions and sometimes feel justified in them. Scott, I got to tell you, we have Black and brown people in particular. We have long cultural memories, and not just our experiences, but what we get from our parents and grandparents. And we have night after night after night, frankly, of sometimes feeling disrespected by police officers, biased against and oppressed. And so it's also asking a lot of people to, you know, develop a different impression of police, you know, break out and actually feel good about the people that are policing their communities. And so, as I've been going on for a second here, if we feel we can ask that of people in the street, we have to be able to ask that of government employees.
Well, my next question was, and I actually heard the chief say this, that Lancaster City Police Force needs to be more representative of the people who live in the city. Let's face it, there's a large African-American population, a large Latino population, a large population of people of color. Do you agree with that?
I mean, absolutely, but like I said, there are long cultures and traditions and histories and things that have to be overcome that can't be changed simply by changing the color of the police. So a couple of things there. First and foremost, you know, it's not always just about the race of the officers, but we need officers that have more of a connection to our community. A lot of officers, Scott, don't live in Lancaster City, and the most recent under the most recent union contract, they don't even actually have to live in Lancaster County. So we talk about wanting our officers to have empathy and connection to people. If you're driving in, for example, from Mechanicsburg and then leaving for Mechanicsburg again in the evening, how are you building real community community relationships with people?
Do you have police officers living in Mechanicsburg?
Mechanicsburg was just an example.
I know, but I was wondering if that was an example or you actually have police officers living there.
We do have officers that from outside of Lancaster County. And if you'd like, Scott, I can forward you a list, though I'm not a list of other places where officers live. But I would, and somebody's going to check me on this, I'm not even sure the majority of our officers reside in the city of Lancaster, much less the communities they police in. As you know, Scott, Lancaster is a more geographically divided city than a lot of us would like to admit.
We have an email here from a listener in Lancaster, Tony. He says, I was at one of the protests and I saw some of those provocateurs. What is your suggestion for dealing with them when you're at a demonstration?
Yeah, thank you, Tony. That's a great question, and I appreciate you keeping your eyes open and your head on a swivel. The answer to that is you're going to want to communicate it directly to a city official or a legal observer, and the legal observer are the folks you'll see in yellow pennies. And I just want to discourage anybody from, you know, individually confronting an individual they think is a provocateur or maybe does wishes to do them or the group harm.
You know, Mayor Sirachi said she encouraged people, and I think you did too, from the quotes I read, to stay home from the demonstrations. That kind of defeats the purpose, though, doesn't it? If you want the issue of racial injustice to be noticed, but you're telling people to stay home.
Yeah, that's a challenging one, Scott. And, you know, thinking about the press conference yesterday. I think I certainly could have been more articulate and specific. I do want people to stay home and be safe, and I also want them to be out here protesting injustice in impactful, effective ways. And I think that the truth of the matter is, you've highlighted a specific tension, and the one that I don't know how to resolve. I am worried about people's safety and want them to stay home, and I also want them to be out here pushing progressive change forward.
Final question, Councilman. What is Lancaster doing? I know you've been involved for years in the community, but you're involved in the poverty research project under the former mayor. What is Lancaster doing to make the city more inclusive for people of color?
You know, my immediate reaction, Scott, was to think of the enormity of the thing that we're attempting to take on, you know, in size to the possibility of our efforts as individuals. But as a community, there's the community police working group. We've had a review and retooling of the use of force, which hopefully at least can serve as a better guidance document, and of course that came in the wake of the tasing of Sean Williams. I think, Scott, the best way to answer that is, and I've gone down the policing road, let me back up. One, I want to encourage everybody to call in to Councilor Xavier Garcia Molina's town hall at 5 p.m. today to talk about more about this issue and specifically policing. And to actually answer your question, Scott, which I apologize for not doing right off the bat, I think there are reviews being done certainly within council about how we can make sure that our boards and authorities, that people are indeed getting, you know, getting into positions where they're being represented. And I think the most important thing that we're doing, not just elevating, you know, specific leaders, but really reconsidering how it is that we spend our money in the Southeast and Southwest, disproportionately rented, disproportionately African-American and Latinx communities. Because, you know, it's not enough, Scott, to just say, oh, we made the leadership a more diverse color of well-off bourgeois people. We need, like, actual black and brown people who are struggling with poverty to be able to get housing, find a good job, access the health care that they need. And so that comes into our budgets as a moral document, the spending of CDBG dollars and others.
Lancaster City Council President Ismael Smith Wade L., thank you very much for being with us today.
Hey, thank you for your time, Scott. Have a good day.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. You're home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Welcome back to Smart Talk. WHYY radio reporter Avi Wolfman Arendt was arrested during a demonstration in Philadelphia Sunday, even after clearly stating he was a journalist. He's one of a growing number of media members who have been injured or arrested during protest. We're joined now by Avi Wolfman Arendt. Avi, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, so what happened on Sunday?
Yeah, so I was asked by my editor to cover what ended up being actually a really small protest that began outside of police headquarters in Philadelphia around 4 o'clock. In fact, the turnout was so small they didn't really get started till 4:30 because they were waiting for more people. I'm normally an education reporter at the station, and so if people have heard my voice before, that's probably the context they've heard it in. But, you know, it's an all-hands-on-deck thing right now. And so I was covering this protest. It had just started when the best way to describe it is that police seemed very eager to sort of start advancing their line and arresting people. And I was arrested for what they called failure to disperse. They claimed they gave a large warning. I didn't hear it. No one else that I was with heard it, including the photographer who was with me. And basically they arrested me. As I told them, I was pressed. They said I didn't disperse fast enough.
Well, when you said that you were with the media, what was the reaction from, was it one police officer, two police officers?
So I was sort of cuffed and detained by just one officer who I didn't actually see coming. And I should mention that this was this small rally was maybe 75 people. There was probably double the amount of police officers. So there's far more police officers than there were protesters for this very small rally. And it was kind of a march. So the protesters were moving away from the police, and the police were tailing them. But the police line kept advancing faster than the protesters could sort of march. And so I was, you know, walking with them, but, you know, a little on the slower side because I was down, you know, taking pictures, tweeting them out. And so because I was one of the slower people walking away, a guy sort of sped up from behind me, an officer, and just pressed me down on the steps of a pretty well-known building in Philadelphia that's right across from Independence Hall called the Curtis Publishing Building. And he pressed me face down, arrested me. I told him I was pressed as it was happening, and he didn't really say anything about it. He just sort of continued on with the arrest.
Where, other than identifying yourself verbally, did you have anything to identify yourself as press?
Yeah, I did. I had my press badge around my neck, a lanyard, that had my name, where I work, WHYY, and my position. That was dangling around my neck. I should also point out that I had a very large fuzzy microphone that radio reporters often carry around with them in these types of situations, and I had my headphones on and a recorder with me, which they continually misinterpreted as a camera. I told them many times it's a radio recorder. They didn't seem to understand the difference. But so basically, yeah, it was pretty clear I was a reporter. I told them they could even check it, Google me. I have a very unusual name, so it's really hard to impersonate me. So it didn't matter. I was arrested.
So from what I understand, by the way, before, let me take a step back. You said that there were twice as many police officers as demonstrators. How are these police officers outfitted?
They had shields and helmets for the most part. They did have batons, although I didn't see them using the batons. I mean, I saw them sort of wielding them and raising them, but I didn't see them striking anyone with batons. Clearly, some of them had tear gas because many protesters were tear gassed. I didn't see any rubber bullets. So it appears that it was tear gas. And, you know, they all have holstered weapons as well. I didn't see them actually use those, but that's, you know, typical police officer, I think, equipment.
You did not hear the police officers tell the crowd to disperse. Is that correct?
That's correct. And I talked with many protesters. And again, I had a photographer with me who was not arrested. But you know, I certainly asked her, did you hear anything? And we didn't. Now, you know, this is a confusing, noisy scene. Protesters are chanting. People are, you know, screaming and trying to get tear gas out of their eyes. I'm busy trying to cover it. And of course, I have headphones on, right? Because I'm a radio reporter. So, you know, it's very possible. I think there was helicopters overhead, so it's very possible I didn't hear it. But I did my best to try to figure out if anyone heard this, and I couldn't find a single person who did. We have not heard anything from the Philadelphia police. They say they're doing some sort of internal investigation.
From what I understand, then it was about a half hour between the time you were thrown in the back. When I say thrown, okay, you were put in the back of a police van with five or six other protesters as well. And I understand you took the opportunity to interview some of the people that some of your arrestees, fellow arrestees. What did you learn?
Yeah, so there was actually eight of us total in the back of a small van, darkened van with little ventilation. And it was really hot. That was probably the most uncomfortable part. They did take away my recording equipment, but I still identify myself as press to everyone in the van and said I would love to talk with them about their experiences. And one thing I learned, this particular protest ended up being mostly young, mostly white protesters. What I learned from a lot of them is this: I was along for the ride for their first arrest experience. Like, they had never, only one guy said he'd been arrested before at a protest. And I thought that was interesting. It felt like a lot of people who were sort of newly engaged in this form of political action. And so I took that as a sign that, you know, there are sort of new people being drawn in by this moment. And, you know, the rest of what I learned is just sort of the routines and the mechanisms of being arrested and transported to a police station and, you know, booked and then released. And that was stuff I just hadn't experienced before.
Were you fingerprinted?
actually was not fingerprinted, nor was I read my Miranda rights.
So
it's interesting. It was an arrest and detention, but I was never really charged. I was given what I have a little slip in front of me. It's called a code violation notice for failure to disperse. We're still trying to figure out actually exactly what it is, but it's something they've been giving a lot of people in Philadelphia this weekend and now into this early part of this week. I was photographed, so I have a mugshot, but they did not fingerprint me. And so it's some sort of odd in-between where I guess they don't feel compelled to read you your rights, they don't feel compelled to fingerprint you, but they do give you this slip, and they detain you, and they transport you, and they release you, and they ended up releasing me in North Philadelphia about 70 minutes after I was first cuffed.
So, Avi, one of the reasons that this is so noteworthy, first of all, it's unusual that journalist would be arrested during a protest. But the other reason that it is so noteworthy at this time in the country's history is that, unfortunately, you are not an exception this time, that there have been a number of journalists around the country who have been injured or arrested, some injured pretty badly. What does it say about what's going on right now when there are journalists who are doing their jobs but yet are caught up in this?
Yeah, it's something I've been thinking a lot about recently and still trying to sort of process my own thoughts on. And they've actually changed pretty significantly since I was first arrested. When I was arrested on Sunday afternoon, as far as I knew, I was the only journalist who'd been arrested in Philadelphia so far. And I thought it was because the officer came at me from behind, I thought it was possible, and still think it's possible, that he just didn't quite see that I was a journalist. And by the time he'd cuffed me, you know, you can't at that point make an exception, because technically I guess I was breaking the same failure to disperse law as everybody else there. And so I kind of processed it through that lens. But since, I know of at least two other journalists who've been arrested at protests in Philly, again, clearly identifying themselves, including one who was just walking home to her car after a protest and was arrested for breaking curfew when she clearly has an exception to do that and had a press badge and told them she was pressed. And so that makes me think about things differently, and it makes me think that right now the police, if they're not openly hostile, they're at least indifferent to some of the rules that are supposed to protect journalists in these situations so that we can record and document the way protesters are treating police and the way police are treating protesters. Hmm. That's what they're due. I mean, I recorded both sides of it. I recorded protesters being extremely verbally abusive to the police. I recorded police being extremely verbally abusive back and physically rough with the protesters, and that's what I was there to do. And I feel like we need someone to witness that and document it so that people of all stripes and opinions have a chance to see what actually happened. And so, yeah, I'm certainly concerned, and I'm no expert on this. Again, I'm just an education reporter. I usually cover classrooms in school, and I'm interviewing teachers and principals. So this is kind of new to me. But, yeah, I'm certainly concerned for what happened to me, and maybe even more so for what's happened over the last couple of days in Philadelphia to other journalists.
Well, Avi, thank you very much for being with us today. And that's quite an experience and a story that you had to tell. And it should wake up a lot of people across this country. WHYY radio reporter Avi Wolfman Arendt. Avi, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's, unfortunately, that is something that is unique about a lot of these demonstrations across the country. And it's something that, you've heard it in the past, but maybe not as much as you've heard about it over the last week or so, journalists being swept up in this. You know, it's almost a lot of people. Normally, when we would have an election day, a primary election day, that would be top news. That would be our headline all day long. It still may be, but there are a lot of people that, during this coronavirus pandemic that are looking at, they've already voted by mail, or they question whether they're going to go to the polls in person. We wonder about turnout. We wonder about candidates who have not been able to campaign in a normal sense. Nothing has been normal about this. I mean, the primary has been pushed back. But we will, on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we will be doing a wrap-up. I don't know whether I should call it a wrap-up or not. Maybe summarize what occurred today. I don't know if we'll have results or not, but we will be talking about today's primary election on tomorrow's Smart Talk, so be sure to tune in. Switching gears, 77% of Americans support the idea that people should wear face coverings in public, and that includes a majority of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. It's one of the few issues where there isn't a wide disparity on response to the coronavirus, according to the latest nationwide public agenda USA Today Ipsos poll released last week. David Scheifler is Director of Research for Public Agenda, and he joins us now. He was with us last March when we talked about the poll last March. Mr. Scheifler, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so what kind of information were you looking for in this poll?
So with this survey, we, again, as part of our whole Hidden Common Ground initiative at Public Agenda, we're looking to find out, you know, where are there areas of agreement across party lines, and where are there genuine areas of disagreement that need to be bridged or that need to be worked through, with the idea that, you know, there may be more agreement out there on some of our more controversial issues than is commonly acknowledged. And so with this survey, we were interested in tracking how communities are responding, how people think that their communities will cope, and also getting into some of the questions about reopening and the sort of how to get that balance right between protecting people's health and the economy.
So what was the biggest takeaway in your opinion?
You know, I think that we did see a lot of continuity between these findings and our March findings. Over three quarters of Americans feel that the economy should be reopened slowly and with safety measures in place to avoid spreading the virus. And this sentiment spanned majorities across political affiliations. And in fact, on a lot of the questions that we asked about, we did see quite a bit of agreement across party lines. And I think that sort of cuts against the image that we may have of this sort of irrevocably divided electorate public, where I do think that there's a fair amount of agreement on some pretty common sense approaches to reopening.
But, you know, when I saw the results, I thought to myself, as you said, there's agreement between Republicans, Democrats, Independents on opening the economy slowly. But I don't know. Slowly is kind of a subjective thing. How do you measure what slowly is? So I wondered about whether Republicans and Democrats had a different idea of what slowly is. You really didn't have a way to ask that kind of question, but I was just curious about that. But one of the most significant changes from your last poll in March was people who believe the government's main responsibility should be to keep the virus from spreading. The percentages of Americans who believe that went down. Now, it's still 62%, almost two-thirds, believe that that's the government's most important responsibility. But why did it go down, and what was the change from March?
Yeah, so where we did see it go down on that question is among Republicans. So right now, we have 41% of Republicans say that the government's main priority should be to prevent the virus from spreading. But in March, 64% of Republicans said that. So that's a pretty tremendous shift among Republicans on that question, whereas Democrats, pretty much unchanged. Independents, a little bit of a difference, but nothing nearly so dramatic as that change among Republicans.
And I just want to say that we will be asking about the similarities here in just a moment, so that listeners don't think that we're just out there to sow discord amongst those where it already exists. But another big disparity, in fact, I think in your news release you mentioned this may have been the biggest disparity between Republicans and Democrats and independents, was on prohibiting gatherings of 10 or more people until there is a treatment or a vaccine. Tell me about that disparity.
Yeah, it's interesting. That was, of all the questions we asked about reopening, that was the one where we did see the biggest difference. So a majority of Americans overall support the idea of prohibiting gatherings of 10 or more, but only just about half of Republicans support it, whereas pretty much three quarters of Democrats support that idea, and independents are just right about in the middle. So there's it's interesting. There's something about this idea maybe of these personal gatherings that maybe are the idea of prohibiting personal gatherings maybe seems to rub some people the wrong way, whereas compared to some of the other questions that we asked about on reopening where we didn't see those same differences.
You know, I mentioned in the introduction that more than three quarters of those polled supported the continuation of wearing face masks in public. And I have to say that that was a bit of a surprise that the numbers were that high, because let's face it, the face mask has become a symbol of discord or division across the country. And there are a lot of people, I mean, even those who support it, a lot of people say, oh, I hate this face mask. I hate having to wear this face mask. But your poll shows 77% will support continued wearing of face coverings once, you know, things are a little bit better. But, they really don't have a target date when any of this would end or to take the face mask off. So that shows that even across all three, Democrat, Republican, Independent, that most people will support the wearing of face mask.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you're right. I think face masks are such a visible symbol of how people deal with the pandemic on a personal level. And I also was surprised at not just the level of support overall, but the fact that, we have majority support for wearing face masks across the parties. Now, there is a difference. I mean, there's a 20-point difference in support between Republicans and Democrats. So it's two-thirds of Republicans support wearing face masks in public. But 87% of Democrats and three-quarters of independents support it. So there are certainly stronger support among Democrats than Republicans. But, I too was surprised at this. I do sort of wonder, we asked about wearing face masks in public, and I kind of wonder, what counts as being out in public for people? And, I think it gets to that question you asked about, what does it mean to reopen slowly? And maybe the same question here is sort of like, if we dug into just how strict people thought they were going to be about face masks, maybe we would uncover more difference. But it's not as striking as I expected to see.
Mr. Schaefer, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. There is a lot of information with this. How do you want this information to be used?
I mean, I think it's important to understand where people are. I think it's important to understand where people are agree so that we can actually focus on the areas of disagreement and see what are the conflicts that really need to be bridged. I think if we have this idea that there's this absolute disagreement on every issue, then it's sort of hard to make progress, and it's hard to find ways to talk across our real differences if we don't sort of start with acknowledging where we do actually agree on some of these seemingly quite contentious issues.
And there are a lot of questions there, a lot of great information, useful information. David Schleifer is Director of Research for Public Agenda. The poll was Public Agenda USA Today, Ipsos poll released late last week. We have a link to it on our website, WITF.org/smarttalk. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on David on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Pennsylvania counties say they need more funding from the state for mental health treatment and support, and it is even more critical during the COVID-19 pandemic. Joining us now is Clinton County Commissioner Jeff Snyder, who is president of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania. Commissioner Snyder, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So I remember at the beginning of the year, beginning of 2020, that CCAP, the County Commissioners Association, said that money from the state, more support from the state for mental health services was your priority for this year. But now you're saying it is even more critical. Why?
Well, with the current COVID-19 pandemic, we've seen further stress on the mental health system with more people than ever needing to help. For the access to the critical services that we have, we've seen an increase in child referrals for case management and treatment services. We have more requests for housing support services, and some of that's due to the discharges that the state had at the state correction facilities, and children and youth waiting to access residential treatment. There's a significant increase in children intakes, mainly for behavioral problems, and a big increase in crisis outreaches and assessment for adults due to the pandemic and shelter in place.
What specifically has the pandemic caused? I mean, I think a lot of people can picture it, can imagine it, but what have counties seen across the state?
Well, what we're seeing is an increase in crisis services, domestic violence, and drug overdoses. You know, once people can get out again, we'll see a significant increase in the need for behavioral health services. We have many people that are dealing with grief and guilt over the loss of a loved one from the virus, and that's compounded with having the lack of the traditional tools of mourning since the shelter in place. Many of those seeking services don't have Medicaid or any other types of insurance. So if the counties do not have the resources to help support them with some of the basic services, they'll end up supporting through other crisis services.
As I said, this was the County Commissioners Association priority at the beginning of the year, even before the COVID-19 pandemic. One of the reasons is that the association has said that the state has underfunded these services for years. Talk about that, and then we'll talk about what more or how much more is needed.
Well, Clinton County is a non-block grant county, and Clinton County is part of a bi-county joinder with Lycoming County. In the fiscal year 2004 to 2005, we saw from that year to the fiscal year 2012, a $1.1 million base funding decrease. Now, that has increased a little bit now into our current fiscal year of 19, but we're still $500,000 less than we were back in 2004. And with the need for the services, Scott, we're hearing from school districts that they are identifying mental health issues in elementary children. We truly believe that with increase in fundings, that if we can address those concerns today, not only will we save money in future, but we'll be adding to that individual's ability to have a productive life. We're asking the county, the state for a $42 million increase. That sounds like a lot, but there's six sets across the state. There's 67 counties. If you divided that equally, that's a little over $600,000 for each county if they were to divide it equally. That's what we're looking for.
So I want to take a step back. Clinton County, as a Clinton County Commissioner, obviously Clinton County is one of the more rural counties in Pennsylvania, one of the least populated counties. So, when you're talking about $1 million reduction, that's probably a lot smaller than what some of the more populated counties have seen, right?
Right, and that's the problem. I don't have the statistics for the other counties, but absolutely, the other counties have seen also significant decreases, and yet the request demand for services is increasing. And it's up to the counties to provide those services.
Well, let's bring that point up. There may be some people who would say, well, why is this on the counties? Why is it on the counties?
It's on the counties because there was a Disability Act of 1966 that requires the counties to provide these services for individuals with complex mental health needs. In 1966, there were over 35,000 individuals that resided in civil state hospital beds across Pennsylvania. Today, that number is less than 1,000. So those numbers have decreased, and the responsibility now lies on the counties instead of the state. Mm.
And something else you said that I just wanted to clarify for our listeners, you said that Clinton County is not one of the block grant programs. What is a block grant? And because a lot of people may not know what that means and why it is significant that Clinton County is not part of that.
Actually, we're looking. We have been talking with Lycoming County about looking at a block grant. And the block grant, and I'm not an expert on this, I will tell you, we're just starting to investigate this now. Block grant monies come from basically the name. You get a block of money to use the way that you see the need for it. One of the issues that we have as a non-block grant county is the money comes to us, we refer to it as silos. And if 20-some percent of ours is designated to be for the mental health base allocation, we can't use more than 26% of our allocation for anything other than the base allocation. So that causes us issues because, basically I've had talks with the legislators. They just don't trust us to be able to use the money where we need it. And if we don't spend it out of that particular silo, it returns to the state.
Okay, something you just mentioned, you said that the legislators don't trust you to use the money. That's probably another issue we could do another show on.
I would think so.
But at the same time, the reality is the state right now is looking at an estimated $5 billion budget shortfall. How is the state going to be able to provide $42 million more, even if the state admitted, and I think they would, that these are important services?
We're really concerned about that because we anticipate. Now, we're very grateful for the short-term budget that the state is doing right now to keep the funds flowing. But in reality, the state must seriously invest in county health funds to shore up the existing services and the capacities needed with the additional funding. But, Scott, I think everybody in the state of Pennsylvania must be very concerned about the amount of funding that they have directed towards the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm one of those who does not believe that there's anything called free money. I don't think free money exists, and I'm very concerned that we're going to be seeing some major cuts within the state budget that are going to affect county government.
Let me ask you this. If that money does not come from the state, this is a mandate, this is a state mandate, but if that money does not come from the state, will it be left on the taxpayers of Clinton County or the other 66 counties across the state?
Well, it's either the burden will come to the county taxpayers or services will have to be streamlined or even eliminated. There's no other choice when you come to government. You either provide the service or if you don't have the funding for it, you have to cut the service. And that's the thing that we're very much concerned about.
And just to clarify a point that you made earlier, you're saying that, and this is a forecast, but I have seen other people who have, a lot of organizations and people have made this forecast, that there will be more people in need of these mental health services after this pandemic, something called pandemic trauma. You agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're seeing it already. We're seeing, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, we're seeing more services required for children. We're seeing more services required, asked for by our veterans. Absolutely. It's already starting.
Mm-hmm. Clinton County Commissioner Jeff Snyder is president of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania. Commissioner Snyder, thank you very much for bringing this to our attention, and thank you for being on the program today.
Thank you. It's been an honor. Thank you, sir.
Coming up on tomorrow's show, we will recap today's primary election in Pennsylvania, so be sure to tune in.